transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for joining us on the show this week. First off, we chat with financial expert Marisha Takor on how to deal with finances in your relationship. We also chat with producer and director Rod Pyle on the U.S. Space Shuttle program now that it's coming to a close with the last two shuttle missions scheduled in the next couple of months. I also have something to say on the Charlie Sheen nightmare, and then we play a killer mashup remix featuring Lady Gaga and Madonna. We've got lots to do. Let's go.
Capture your need for sound.
Saving money and taking care of our finances can feel like a daunting task. And when you add a relationship into the mix where we have to be aware of our combined financial resources, well, that just brings things to a whole other level. With us today is Manisha Takor, an expert on women's finances. A Harvard graduate, Manisha is actually the author of two critically acclaimed books, including Get Financially Naked, How to Talk Money with Your Honey. She's also been featured in the New York Times, as well as in Glamour.com's Five Things You Need to Know About Money and Relationships. Manisha, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Kelly, thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, I have to ask you, you know, I was reading your article in Glamour, and I have to ask you, what does it actually mean to be financially compatible with your mate?
Oh, you know, that's like the million-dollar question. In retrospect, wish that I had chosen a slightly different term than compatible, because compatible implies that you're in agreement on everything, and that was not the underlying intent. So I view a financially compatible couple as a couple that talks honestly and openly about money, figures out where you have areas of personality differences, and 99% of couples have them, and then you come up with a tactical game plan that you both feel good about, where both your needs are met, and you're still doing what's best for your overarching household. So it does not mean that you both have to be the same.
Okay, perfect. I'm glad that that was sort of clarified, because, you know, I think a lot of people end up being with people that they're not always compatible with everything. So I see the thread there. And what are the five, I guess, top things that we need to know about money and relationships? Because, you know, everyone always hears that old adage that, you know, money is what causes couples to bicker.
Well, and it is what causes couples to bicker, Kelly, and academic studies have recently shown why. Turns out, during the dating process, there's something incredibly intoxicating about what academics call financial otherness. So if you're a saver, the freewheeling ways of a spender will seem really exciting to you. Like when I'm a saver, when my husband took me out to movies and asked if I wanted Coke and a popcorn, I was like, drooling. And conversely, my husband thought it was the cutest thing that I insist on going through airport security with an empty water bottle and I refill it on the other side because I can't bear to spend $4 on a bottle of water in the airport. But that wears off. And so the first tip really is that the couple that pays together stays together. And so I find that couples that sit down and come up with a strategy of how they're going to handle their finances together, who's going to handle the administrative tasks of paying bills, and then coming together jointly to make sure that you're on the same page philosophically about how much you're spending, that's step number one.
Okay. And then just a question on that, you know, because I think a lot of women, at least in the past, would sort of hand things over to the man. And that frightens me, you know, even just knowing that women did that in the past and that potentially that's happening now.
And it is. And part of the reason is, many working women are incredibly smart, but they're also incredibly busy and time crunch. So it's just easier if you're not interested in money to just hand it off if somebody else is interested in it. And then also still societally, we as women are not as encouraged to take those financial reins. So one solution that I really like is encouraging couples to make active use of online banking, where both spouses always have access to all household financial information at all times. It's like a financial control tower, and you both can step in whenever you want.
So that would be like another tip then is to go online and do it that way.
Yeah, so what I kind of lump it under the first tip when I say when you pay together, a great way to make sure that you're paying together is that you utilize online banking capabilities at your primary bank that you both have access to. If you've got investment accounts, often they have bill paying options or just, you know, online options where you can check your holdings and your performance, and making sure that both spouses always have access to all the information.
And then what would be the next tip?
Yeah, the next one, and I feel kind of harsh saying this, Kelly, but it's, and I mean this from a loving place towards men, but don't assume Prince Charming has a financial clue. I'm 40 years old. My husband's 20 years older than me, and it's amazing to me when we are out socially, people just assume that I'm a trophy wife, and they wonder why he didn't get a skinnier, prettier trophy wife. And they have, like, you know, like, no concept that I spent 15 years as a portfolio manager, and I'm a Harvard MBA. And I listen to them talk, Kelly, and I want to burst out laughing. It's like they're speaking pig Latin at each other. And the reason is not that men are dumb. It's that none of us were taught, or most of us were not taught personal finance. So don't assume that your guy has it all figured out. There's an awful lot of pressure on men to man up and pretend they understand this stuff when they weren't any more educated about it than we were.
Wow. And I just think that's amazing. I think that's such a great tip for women to keep in their head, that just because it's a man, it doesn't mean that they have any idea what's happening. Because I think a lot of guys aren't interested in money either, and they've just been able to sort of flub along. So that's fantastic. And then where do we go next?
So the next one is, I really feel strongly that you want to use technology to make sure that your money is doing what you want it to do. There is just, when I see people at the cash register writing out checks by hand, I want to cringe, because I really feel like we're also strapped these days. There are wonderful websites like Mint.com or ZashPay.com. Mint.com is a wonderful place where you can keep your budgeting. ZashPay.com is a really interesting website where you can literally, you know, like, let's say a group of you are going out for an office party to celebrate somebody's departure, and you're each chipping in $20. Rather than have somebody collect all that money individually, you can all sign up for ZashPay and send it to each other electronically. So as overwhelming as it may seem to start paying attention to some of these online tools for your personal finances, once you get them set up, oh, the time they release. Amazing.
I'm so glad that you said that, because I think there's like a fear, whether it's male or female, almost to sign up for these things. And I know, like, for me, like, I have a certain amount that is done online, and it obviously has made my life a bunch easier. And then there's other things where I just, it's almost like it's too much for me to have to deal with signing something else up. But I think you just, like, you know, you have to barrel through it, and then the other side, you know, the pot of gold's there.
It's like giving childbirth, you know? I mean, it's just like, just make it through labor and, you know, and the terrible twos, and the rest is great.
Okay, that's fantastic. Well, I think that's just an awesome, again, a tip for people to put in their head and to push forward and get this handled so that, you know, you are saving time at the back end. And then where do we go from there after that?
The next one is right into kids, and this is highly politically incorrect, but I'm going out on a limb and saying it, which is that kids are cute and cuddly, but they are incredibly costly. And so while it is a natural parental instinct to want to give your kids the best, it may not be the best for your kids, and it certainly may not be the best for your finances. So if I'm using, you know, U.S. dollars, it's estimated that a child born last year will cost mom and dad $220,000 to raise from 0 to 18, and that's before you factor in any college costs.
Oh, my God.
The point isn't, I know. Is it not?
Oh, my God. I was like, for sure that's 4 years of college in there. Oh, my God.
No. I mean, it's you know, basically it's anywhere from, you know, $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 a year to raise a child when you include food and activities and insurance and education outside of school, not even private school, but just supplemental classes and things. It's very expensive, and it's something that we don't talk about. So a lot of people will say to me, I really am trying to be good with my money, but I'm struggling. And I'm like, honey, you've got three or four kids. And it doesn't mean don't have three or four kids, but just understand that then there will have to be trade-offs in other areas. Maybe each child will not have their own bedroom. You will have to share bathrooms unless you're very fortunate and have a big income. And it's not the end of the world if that's the case. But there are trade-offs, and just to make sure that parents are aware of the price tag that the love bundles come with.
Well, you know, and I think it's important that you mention that, because, you know, I, and again, you want to be understanding for the people that, you know, want to have a large family, but I think you really do need to sit down in this day and age and really figure out, you know, if three kids is something that you can do adequately, you know, or should you just go for the two, you know? So I think it's something that people, go on.
It's huge. I have a friend who has six children, and for religious reasons, she feels very strongly procreation is something incredibly important to her and her husband. But then they also decided, you know what, we have three bedrooms, and there are eight of us in this house, and that's just how it's going to be, because we're going to make the trade-off. And they don't go out to eat, and clothes get passed down, and they make ends meet, but they've made a trade-off.
Okay, well, I think, you know, and that's great that they were aware enough to do that, because I think a lot of people get caught up in the cute little baby syndrome and then don't think about the end result. It's scary.
Exactly.
It's scary. And then are we, I think we're on tip five now, so what does that mean?
The very last one is a simple one, which is just that the money talk is never a one-and-done talk with your sweetie. Life is constantly changing. One of you may lose a job. One of you may get a promotion. There may be illness in the family. There may be elder care issues. So I encourage couples to at least once a year sit down and discuss what you own and owe as a household, what you earn and what you spend as a household, and are you saving and are your investments performing in line with your expectations? And if not, to come up with a new game plan for the year ahead. You just don't want to put the head in the sand, which is the natural human tendency, because this stuff is overwhelming and frankly boring for a lot of us.
Right. That's true. I know. I think a lot of people are bored. And then that whole fear factor that's there as well. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show this week is Manisha Thakur, a woman's financial expert in general, financial expert, as well as an author. Make sure you check her out at www.manishathakur.com. I have a couple of questions, I guess, based off of things that you've just been saying. First of all, maybe this is a bit more of a psychological question, but why does money, you know, end up being such a big issue for, you know, couples, whether it's heterosexual or, you know, a gay or lesbian relationship?
I think it's two reasons. In any kind of coupling situation, money is power. Money gives you choices. It gives you a voice. It gives you freedom. And whenever there are issues of power, it's just kind of human nature going back literally thousands of years that there are power struggles. And on top of it, the piece that's really toxic is that it's a subject that we're not encouraged to talk to each other about. So society does encourage you as parents to discuss who's in charge of this or who's in charge of that, but money is this big pink elephant floating around in our bedrooms. So it's very important, and we're not given tools or language to discuss it with each other.
Okay. And is there something that you would say to women, you know, regarding, you know, if they're just sort of, you know, coming out of university now and really heading off towards their life, what would you say to these young women to sort of start them off on the right foot about, you know, I guess, A, planning their financial future sort of in the present and then down the line, because I'm sure a lot of people are women are single at this point coming out of university. Yeah. And then, you know, how should they think or change their thinking when they do become a couple and then, you know, proceed down that line as well?
So the single most important advice that I can give a young woman in her 20s and 30s is to live below your means. And you know you're living below your means if you are able to tuck away somewhere between 10 and 20% of your take-home pay. And if that sounds like a staggering amount to tuck away, now you know how we ended up in this global financial crisis. Most of us were spending way beyond our means. And if you tuck that money away and you start investing in your 20s and 30s in a low-cost mix of stock and bond mutual funds, it will literally transform your life. In your 40s, 50s, when you're married, when more complex situations involving kids come, you will have the financial weaponry and power and choices to create the life that makes your heart sing. But it will require some trade-offs early on. And I think that's the biggest message that young people of both genders don't get. Don't try and live like mom and dad right out of the gate. Tuck away 10 to 20%, invest it wisely over the long run. You will be amazed in your mid, I'm 40, and what, doing that in my 20s and 30s has enabled me in my 40s now to work full time doing exactly what I love to do.
And what do you say as well to, and again, I don't even want to just say it as young women, because I think, you know, young men are in this boat as well. I think a lot of us are intimidated by not understanding money and how we should save it and who we should speak to help doing it. I think a lot of us think that, you know, if we're not careful, we're going to get, you know, involved with some sort of financial advisor that really doesn't know what they're doing. So what do you say on that end to women and men who want to do the right thing but feel like they're stupid, really?
Couple things. Number one, you are not alone. I mean, almost, and it's a very healthy reaction that you have. It's a good fear to feel that way. Number two, if someone suggests you do something with your money and you don't fully understand what it is that they're suggesting and how they are being compensated for that advice, you don't want to go there. And the third thing is that no one else will ever care about your money as much as you do. And so self-educating yourself about personal finance, which is not something that we're necessarily taught to do, is key. And it doesn't have to be that hard. Reading a couple of good basic books on personal finance, signing up for a blog or two that you might like on personal finance, studying it for 2 to 3 years, and wham, you've got a lifetime of knowledge then that you can build on. And it doesn't take that much time. It just requires the discipline to delve into a topic that may not be the most scintillating.
And do you have any suggestions for some of those books maybe that people could sort of look into or at least where they could find sound financial advice? Because again, I think there's so many of these get-rich-quick schemes or you know what I mean? And I think when you go into the financial section in a bookstore, it's scary.
It totally is. Well, self-servingly, I have written co-authored two personal finance books. One is called On My Own 2 Feet. The other is called Get Financially Naked. The first is a primer on the basics of personal finance. The second is a primer on how to deal with money and relationships. Both are available on Amazon.com or your local libraries. And you don't get rich writing books, I'll tell you that. I make about 50 cents a copy. So it's not, this isn't sending me off into the stratosphere. It really was a labor of love. I also highly recommend a book by a gentleman named Dave Ramsey, and the book is called The Total Money Makeover. And if you're struggling with debt, there's a wonderful book by Gene Chatsky called Pay It Down. Those are some of my favorite books. And just for a good overarching viewpoint on how to think about money in the context of your life, the vintage classic book is called Your Money or Your Life by Vicki Robin and Joe Dominguez. All of these books are paperback, so you can get them for less than $15. And really can change your life. And in terms of finding financial advice, I'm a big fan of fee-only independent financial advisors that charge you either an hourly rate in exchange for advice or a flat percent of assets under management. So there's not a commission structure involved. They're not incented to sell you products, that they're literally getting paid in exchange for providing you advice on the totality of your financial picture.
And I guess, you know, another question that I would have for you is, as, you know, we go through life, like you said, you know, the 20s and the 30s, and it doesn't seem too long before you are into those 40s and 50s. Should you be aware as an individual, it's not even should you be aware, you need to be aware as you go through these different life stages that you're constantly monitoring your finances and how your life is changing what you need those finances to do for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in your 20s, a key challenge is to learn to live within your means. In your 30s, a key challenge is really to set it to up your savings rate if you haven't been able to, so you've got the money for down payments on homes, cars, weddings, graduate schools. In your 40s, when you start entering your peak earnings year, the key is to avoid lifestyle creep, where you get a job and then you get a bigger car and then you say, oh, my garage isn't big enough for this fancy car. I need a new house. And now that I've got this great house, I need fancier clothes. In your 50s, the key challenge is if you have been a little bit late to the savings game to avoid the urge to go for the big investment home run, but rather reconcile yourself to spending a little less, working a little longer. In your 60s, your prime challenge is not over-nibbling on your nest egg as you enter into your retirement years. And once you're in your 70s, staying healthy is key to keeping healthcare costs down. And 80 and beyond, I say live it up.
What? That's awesome. I'm going to tell my grandma. She'll love that. She's actually...
You're in the live it up stage.
She's in the live it up. The funny thing is she's actually... I've never seen anyone more excited about sales than my grandmother. So that's awesome. Thank you so much. And I just a last question. Is there anything, or maybe if we can just reiterate the main tip that you would have for young women and young men as they launch into their career post-education?
Start saving now. Three most powerful words in personal finance. The money you save and invest for your retirement and your future in your 20s and 30s has the most time to grow and compound. It's painful, but setting aside that 10, 15, 20% early on literally will transform your financial life.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, Kelly, my pleasure. And if people have more questions, I love for people to write to me. And again, as you mentioned, my website is MinishaTalkCore.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. That's author and financial expert. Again, you know where to find her, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, it's official. Actor Charlie Sheen has officially been fired from his hit sitcom, Two and a Half Men. And I don't think any of us are surprised by the actions taken by Warner Brothers. They're the people that are responsible for the show. And from what we understand, there was an 11-page letter sent to Charlie and his lawyer outlining the reasons behind why he was being fired. And apparently there was actually links to websites in this letter. And these links showed, the numerous quotes and ramblings that Charlie himself has made over the situation with Two and a Half Men. And I guess the point being on the side of Warner Brothers is that they wanted to illustrate to both Charlie and his lawyer that, Charlie has really gone off the deep end, and they have concrete proof, that Charlie is no longer, fit to be on the show. So at the time of me talking about this right now, we don't know where Two and a Half Men is going to go. They could try to find another actor to, I don't think, replace his character. I think they would have to take the show in an entirely different sort of direction. Or I guess they could just call it a day. So we'll have to see what happens with that. But, again, overall, it's just a very, very sad situation. Charlie is clearly, not in his right mind. There's times where you see him being interviewed and he seems like he's sort of there and potentially, understands what he's talking about. And then other times he just seems like he's really tweaked. And that's the only word that I seem to be able to use. It's like he's come to a point and he's lost touch, with reality. And I don't know if you watch the show The Talk, which is on CBS, which is on the same network that, Charlie's Two and a Half Men is home to. They were actually on Piers Morgan, the ladies of The View, of The Talk, rather. And they wanted to not really comment at all about what was going on. Piers was trying to get them to give their thoughts, because everyone else in Los Angeles is doing that. But obviously they refused for the most part because I think they share that CBS network. But Sharon Osbourne did sort of say something from a personal standpoint. And I think that she sort of sums it up and wraps it up the best. So this is Sharon Osbourne when she was on Piers Morgan.
I look at it from a mother. If that was my son,
Yeah. That
was my husband, I know the damage that that behavior does to a family. So I'm sad for his family.
Yeah, with Ozzy, you certainly went through pretty hair-raising stuff.
Yeah, and I know how it feels to love someone like that, and the sadness and the damage that it does within a family, within the nucleus of the family. And nobody gets away free. Nobody gets away free. People get damaged. People get hurt. And I just look at it from that, and my heart aches for his family.
Capture your need for sound.
The American Space Shuttle program is coming to a close in the next few months, and with it comes the end of an era. To help us understand what happens next with space exploration is Rod Pyle. He's a writer, producer, and director, and notably wrote and produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel. Rod, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks.
Rod, can you give us a brief overview, of when the shuttle program actually began and some of its major accomplishments? And I know that they've accomplished a lot, but I know there's a few things that stand out probably in your mind.
Yeah, the shuttle program really started as an outgrowth of Apollo, trying to figure out what to do after the moon missions were over. And a lot of people felt they needed a dramatic change. So it was in the 70s that they sold that program. The vote finally went through in 72. And then they got to flying in 82. So it was a long, slow build. And the idea was simply to have something reusable that would hopefully bring costs down by an exponent and make access to space easier and more available. It didn't quite work out that way, but that was the idea. Notable accomplishments are the first large reusable space plane, the first enclosed cargo area for launching things the way they do, the ability to take up more than three people at a time. They could take a crew of up to seven or eight, and the ability to dock with larger structures the way they have been. Although Apollo could do that, it's easier for the shuttle. And it was technologically, it was an exponential jump as well. One other notable thing that they have been able to do and have done a number of occasions is not just take up and deploy things, because any rocket can do that, launch a satellite, but they can launch it. If something doesn't quite work out, they can go out and fix it. By standing on the end of the manipulator arm and going out and dealing with it, and if necessary, retrieve it and bring it back, which was a big first.
And, you know, I think a lot of us, you know, have ideas about what the shuttle program is. And you know, I guess for people that are very much into that sort of thing or space exploration, you know, they would know more. But for people like myself who, you know, are definitely interested in it, but don't sort of, you know, seek it out. There's a couple of things, I guess, that I would want to ask you. Like, first of all, I think a lot of us don't even really have a clue how many shuttles are actually in that U.S. fleet.
There were originally four. And the Challenger was lost in 86, and that was replaced with Endeavour, which was built out of a remaining airframe and spare parts. And then we lost one more when Columbia was re-entering over Texas back in, I think it was 95. No, excuse me. I'm going to have to check that date.
I think it was 2003, right?
Pardon me?
When Columbia came back down, it was 2003, right? February,
2003.
I think?
2003. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, in 2003. So we lost one more in Columbia, was coming back in 2003. And so now we have a fleet of three. The current shuttle that's up, Discovery, will be retired upon its return and sent out to the larger of the two Smithsonian Air and Space Museums in Washington, D.C. And then the remaining two will be sent off to other destinations once they're retired. NASA sent out letters a few years ago to the major museums and so forth, hey, do you want a space shuttle? And they all responded as quickly and as capably as they could. Not an inexpensive endeavor to pull off, as you can imagine. So they're going to be sent hither and yon to museums and static displays.
And you know, with regards to the U.S. and this, you know, space shuttle program coming to a close, are they going to be halting their missions, you know, for the foreseeable future, or is it going to take just a few years to get something sort of up and running so they can get back up there? And I guess in the time being, does that mean that they are going to be going to space with the Russians?
Yeah, there's a couple questions in there. So for the immediate future, we will be hitching rides with the Russians. They're still using the Soyuz spacecraft, which was their answer to Apollo back in the 60s. That was their moonship, and it didn't quite make it, as most people know. But it's proved to be extremely capable in the years since, and they just kind of turned them out like sausages. You know, it's a little more complicated than that, but it's a very robust, proven design. So it's a good way to go up and back. It's a little cheaper than the shuttle, at least now. Whether or not they'll raise the prices, we're not sure. As far as access beyond that, that's a very good question, and it's one that even NASA can't really answer at the moment. There was a plan for a follow-on program you've probably heard of called Constellation, which is going to start flying in about 2 years originally and eventually take us back to the moon. However, with the Obama space budget that got canceled, that budget is still in play. It hasn't been finalized yet, but at the current time, it looks as if there really will not be an American follow-on to the shuttle program. They are going to continue developing a capsule, which looks like an enlarged Apollo capsule on steroids. It'll carry between 4 and 6 people, but we don't have a rocket to launch it on, and we don't really have a mission for it at this point. So for the foreseeable future, whatever access we have will be with the Russians up to the space station and back. Beyond that, there's a lot of talk about building a heavy lift booster that will carry this capsule, which is called Orion, into Earth orbit and beyond to near Earth objects such as asteroids and so forth. But at this point, it's all kind of ill-defined, and we're, as a collective community, kind of wringing our hands waiting to see what the real decision is.
There are so many questions that have just popped into my head with the information that you just, you know, have given us. First of all, is it not shocking to the American, you know, public that their space program is coming to a halt, and unless you hitch a ride with the Russians, you're screwed?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on your age and your generation. Having grown up as a young boy watching the Apollo program and the great race to the moon with the Soviet Union, it is very hard to watch our capability disappear and to not have some nationalistic feelings about it. And we won that competition. We won it handily. And so it's also hard to watch us not have a leadership capability, much less any capability. I mean, eventually, at the end of the day, any access to space is better than none, but it's nice we do ourselves. One thing that's always been a hard sell for space exploration has been, you know, why do we spend, especially during these economic times, why are we spending money to go to space? And NASA has not done the best job of selling their own mission to the American people. And look at a country like China, which has a very aggressively growing space program. They'll have a space station up within 2 years, 3 years, and probably be on the moon by 2020. You know, that system of government doesn't have to ask. They just have to decide. In the United States, we have to ask, and there's Congress and the Senate, and then there's the people in that approximate order. If people are behind it, you could do it. If people aren't, it's a tough sell. Right now, it's a tough sell. There's one more thing I'd like to add, which is there's this notion that's been there since the 60s that when you build spacecraft, you're essentially shoveling money into the door of a capsule and launching into orbit, and it's gone. And it's a difficult concept to disabuse people of. The truth is, of course, NASA and the federal government spending money here on Earth in the United States on something that we do better than almost anyone else, probably better than anyone else, which is build robust, safe spacecraft. And that money is spent on engineering, it's spent on education, it's spent on science, it's spent on all kinds of things that eventually produce great results for the public at large. But it's a difficult concept to get your head around, and I don't think that's been sold well, and so I think support for the program really has waned dramatically.
Joining us on the show is writer, producer, and director Rod Pyle, who produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel. Make sure to check him out, rodpylebooks.com, and that's P-Y-L-E. Rod, another question that came to mind is, what about all these astronauts that, you know, are down in Houston, you know, training? Like, does this mean that a bunch of them aren't actually going to be used? And I know, you know, speaking from a Canadian point, a standpoint, you know, we've had obviously, we've sent astronauts down there to train with you. So does this mean that we're not going to be used in the grand scheme of things? Or again, we're going to have to piggyback with the Russians or with perhaps the Chinese?
We'll be piggybacking. You know, at best, an astronaut, if so let's say an astronaut has a 10-year active career in NASA, they might get two, maybe three missions if they're lucky. I mean, depends a little bit on whether they're a pilot or a mission specialist or what have you. There is a fellow that I interviewed for that Modern Marvel show, which was in 2005, I believe, named Alan Drew, who flew his second mission on the flight that's up there now. So in all that time, he's only now getting his second mission. So he trained, and then finally he got to fly twice. That'll probably be it for him. He might get one or two more to the space station with the Russians. I don't know. So a career is 10 or 20 years with a few flights in there. Most of the time they spend training. They have office jobs. They have assignments within the program that are well beyond their flight. NASA's always run it that way. So there will be things for astronauts to do beyond just training for a specific mission, but they'll definitely be dwindling in numbers. And unless we see an aggressive change in this program in the next few years, there's even been talk of closing the astronaut office altogether. I think that's just talk, but there has been talk of that at some point because they just didn't feel they'd have the numbers to support it.
Wow, I just find this extremely shocking. Like, I just figured that again, the Americans would never let this happen, would not have their shuttle program happening, because it just seems like everything we always hear is that space exploration is so important for research data and things to come in the future. So I find it very shocking. And I guess if we backtrack a little bit, I did have a couple of questions. You know, after that Columbia disaster in 2003, did that really sort of put a dent in the program? Was there ever a doubt that there would be more missions that would go up, or were things, you know, going to come to a halt then too?
Time there's a big problem with the shuttle, there's a slowdown and an examination of what happened. It was predicated historically back in the Apollo years by the Apollo 1 fire in 1967 and by the Apollo 13-year disaster in 1970. And whenever these occur, there's a self-examination. There's always critics in the woods somewhere, usually within government, who say, well, this is proof that it's not safe and we should stop. Truth of the matter is, it's been a remarkably safe program. We only started losing astronauts in any numbers when shuttles broke up just because of their crew capacity. I think that it's wise to self-examine, and NASA does a pretty good job of that. You know, they investigate themselves, and then usually a congressional committee is appointed, and they go ahead and investigate the investigators and reinvestigate the problem. So it's in an odd way a very robust system for investigating failure, and they always come out of it stronger and more capable than before. But to specifically answer your question, yeah, there's always a slowdown, and there's a look at both the people and the hardware and the systems and the management styles and so forth. But really, considering what's been accomplished over the years, and especially what's been accomplished since the Apollo missions, because the budgets were cut dramatically, they do so much more with so much less now. To me, to my mind, it's really a difficult argument to say that we should stop. That said, there is a good argument for unmanned exploration. We get better and better at it. We get more capable. This flight is taking up a device called Robonaut, which is a robotic astronaut. Now, it can't do things by itself. It still needs to be teleoperated, but it can be operated from the ground. Does that mean we should just send robots and not people? I don't think so. And that gets into a whole philosophical discussion about the nature of discovery and exploration, and that's a whole separate talk.
Okay.
but, yeah, I go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. No. I guess another question too I would have for you is with regards to you know, Endeavor and Atlantis being scheduled for their last flights coming up in the next couple of months. I guess, do you know what some of their objectives are when they go to the space station? And then a second part to that, again, for people who are not familiar with the space station, can you give a brief overview of what's up there now?
Yeah, let me do that in reverse order. What we have up there now for the space station is a well-evolved international platform. Most of the hardware is built by the United States and, to a lesser extent, Russia, and then there are contributions from the Europeans and Japan. It's pretty close to finished. I mean, the objective of the shuttle program, once they realized what the end date was and they were going to wind down, was to get all the large pieces up there that nobody else can launch. At this point, the Russians don't really have an active capability for launching that kind of heavy stuff, so it had to go on the payload bay of the shuttle. So it's just about finished. It can hold crews of, I think, up to 12 or 13 people at a time. Very low failure rate. They had one problem with air conditioning a few months ago that was worked out. But compared to earlier efforts like Skylab and the Soviet Union's Mir station, this has been a really successful, incredible, and very modular and flexible design. When I heard that they were thinking of deorbiting the thing in 2015, 2016 time span, that was a real heartbreaker. Now that's extended out to 2020, which makes more sense considering what we spent. But when you think of, again, I'm speaking from the standpoint of a 54-year-old guy. When I was a kid, we were still talking about Wernher von Braun's big wheel in space, and it was science fiction. We have a space station up there now, and it's easy to forget about it because it's not something that's on television. It's not remarkably in the news. But we have a space station up there and people in space all the time. That's a big accomplishment. As far as the remaining shuttle flights, we've got STS-134 coming up sometime around April with Endeavor, and that's going to be a space station parts and installation flight. The final flight, if it gets budgeted, is STS-135 with Atlantis. That's in the June timeframe somewhere. And that takes up a multi-purpose, it's called the ISS Logistics Multi-Purpose Module, which is a fancy name for a pressurized storage bay. They're going to pick up that air conditioning unit that failed a few months back I was talking about, and then they're going to study robotic refueling techniques because a big part of what is going to be happening after the shuttle's retired is that the Russians and later the Europeans, and hopefully us with private industry, will be flying up on manned units more often than manned units. So if we don't have to do a crew exchange, we'll fly up an unmanned, unpressurized module that can take up food, fuel, components, experiments, whatever's needed, and it simply flies up, docks, unloads its cargo, and then comes home.
For people like myself who don't know, again, a couple of questions specifically geared now towards astronauts. First of all, obviously you've dealt with astronauts, you know, in your programming that you've done. As a third person observer, because I actually had the great pleasure to speak to Julie Payette, and it was interesting to sort of hear her, you know, account of what it was like to be on the missions. But I just want to know, for you as a third person, are astronauts a completely like a different breed? Because it feels like, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people that have, you know, very scary jobs and different jobs and things that, you know, are very difficult to achieve. But it almost seems like, you know, they really have to be in a totally different headspace. And then, you know, attached to that, my other question would be, how long are they up in the space station? Because, like, I don't really understand, like, how long these people are up there, if it's like a month or 2 months and then they come back, or
right,
how does that work?
The rotations can last from week to months. I think the longest one for anybody has been about 6 months. And as far as, you know, who these astronauts are, I've interviewed more of the Apollo era people than I have shuttle people. Now, the Apollo guys were all test pilots. They're kind of an extension of the original Mercury 7 astronauts, you know, tough, hard-drinking, hard-charging kind of guys. And they were a very different breed. They're chronic overachievers, but more in a physical and just raw accomplishment kind of mode than now. With the shuttle program, there have been a lot more astronauts brought in, of course, because of the capability of how many they can carry and how many they needed, and a much broader range of types of people, more people of color, different genders and so forth, because it used to be a white man's program way back in the day. And that's all been for the good. And what it did was bring a much stronger sense of ability to the astronaut corps. The one thing that really rings loud and clear when you talk to these people, as you probably discovered, was these people are chronic overachievers. We don't usually see their bios, but they often have at least 2 or 3 degrees, sometimes as many as 5. A lot of them have doctorates. almost all have master's degrees, usually in hard sciences and some specialization within the sciences. Some are doctors. These are people that start achieving at a very, very early age and just never stopped. There's one in particular whose resume I remember who died a few years back, but they named the neutral buoyancy tank facility they have for training after him. At first, he was in the military, and then he decided he wanted to be a doctor, so he went to med school, and he wanted to be a military doctor. And then that wasn't enough, so he went back to become a test pilot, and test piloting was fine for a few years. And he decided, no, what I really want to do is study this branch of medicine. I mean, this guy accomplished more in 10 years than I've accomplished in 54. And it's pretty humbling to spend time talking to these people, because they are still kind of super people in their own way. And I think it's going to be hard for a lot of them to come back to Earth. Another interesting thing, which I just wanted to mention in passing, was just out of curiosity, I looked up what an astronaut makes, because they're a typical, you know, U.S. government pay grade. And they get extra pay for flying, but on average, you start at about $75,000 a year and go up to the mid-hundreds, and that's it. These are not wealthy people. They're middle-class people with these incredibly stressful, high-end jobs who obviously don't mind being cooped up in small spaces for long periods of time, which I think that's probably the main prerequisite. You can't be nervous about small spaces.
That's insane. Well, I would have had no idea. I would have thought they would have at least been over, you know, 200 a year. I would have thought, like, just for even getting in there, because it just seems like you have to be super nerd to make it into the program. And so, and then just a last question.
Super nerd with the body of Superman.
Exactly. That's right.
Make it work.
That's so true. And then, Rod, just back to them being in the space station. I know you said the longest was probably 6 months. Are they up there with like a crew of five or six, or is it varying? And then I'm assuming they have to go through intense training to handle the thoughts of just being way the hell out there.
It depends on the individual. Some do more training than others, and it has less to do with who they are than what the mission is. But yeah, there's a lot of training for any given mission, anywhere from 7 to 1 to 10 to 1 in terms of the amount of time they spend training for any specific task, sometimes a bunch more than that. If it's complicated, like the Hubble servicing missions, you know, the training was extremely intense, because that's a big, dangerous thing to get close to, and you have to be very careful when you're doing it. But as far as their time up there, the space station's pretty large. I mean, compared to previous efforts where you were really inside an orbiting can or a spent booster stage like Skylab, the new space station is a large, comparatively rambling facility. There's windows. There's a thing called the cupola where they can stick their head up and look out windows at different views of the Earth and the cosmos. So it's not quite as intense as it was, and it's gotten, I don't know if comfortable is the word, but it's certainly gotten much more habitable than it used to be. So I think as long as they pass muster in terms of psychological profiles going up, there isn't a whole lot of specific psychological training, because they're already pretty much there.
Okay, fantastic. And Rod, just a final question for you. Looking forward, I know we've sort of briefly spoke about where you think things are headed, but realistically, what do you think is going to happen in the next 5 years for the American shuttle program, just the space program, obviously?
Overall, yeah. I think we're going to stumble along. They still haven't passed a budget for the current year, so NASA's operating off of money that they had in the bank and a whisper and a wish and temporary appropriations and so forth. And this isn't unusual. This happens, but this is probably the first time it's happened where there really hasn't been a specific goal that they are able to hold up and say, this is what we're doing, this is where we're going. And I think we're going to see that continue for a few more years. We've got a few shocks down the line. The Chinese are going to have a space station orbited soon, as I was expressing earlier. The Indians and the Japanese are working very hard on unmanned lunar landers, and the Chinese plan to be on the moon in 2020. If nothing else, I think when 2020 comes around or thereabouts, and the Chinese are up there wandering around possibly at old Apollo landing sites, if not before that, at that point, there's going to be a big shock that ripples through the polity of the United States. A lot of congressmen are going to look at each other and say, how could you let this happen? And the answer is going to be, we all let it happen, and if we want to gain back that access and mastery of space, we're going to have to work very hard to play catch up at that point.
Rod, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. It was a real pleasure.
That's Rod Pyle, writer, producer, and director, and who notably wrote and produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel. Make sure you check him out, rodpylebooks.com. That's R-O-D-P-Y-L-E books.com.
Bring on the Remix.
Doesn't matter if you love him or capital H-I-M. M-M. M-M.
That's Lady Gaga and Madonna with the mashup of their two hit songs, Born This Way and Express Yourself, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, thank you so much for hanging out this week. I always appreciate your time. And I have to tell you, it was so much fun talking to our guests this week, Marisha Takor and Rod Pyle. Thank you so much, you two, for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And I also wanted to give you a heads up for next week's show. We're going to be talking to one of our favorite guests, clinical psychologist Dr. Randy Mazenter from St. Louis, Missouri. She's going to be weighing in on the Charlie Sheen situation and also explaining what being bipolar really means. Because I think, you know, so many people have been throwing that term around when it comes to Charlie Sheen and his behavior, and we really want to know if this is indeed what's going on. So Dr. Mazenter is going to set us straight as much as possible, and also sort of weigh in on his behavior right now and potentially what could be going on and why he's acting this way. So that's coming up next week. Again, if you have any comments or questions, don't be shy. Kelly@KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week, and you and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander, produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.